So you're very welcome. This is our third evening of satsang here at Serene's lovely home, organized by Emily here in London. We've covered a lot of subjects. We've roamed far and wide in some basic Sanskrit philosophy and Vedic philosophy. As most of you, I'm sure, know, the Vedas are the oldest books on the planet, and they date back to about 6,000 BC. They date back much further, but this is when they were recorded. And the Vedas are prolific. There are many, many books in many, many subjects. Every subject under the sun is covered in the Vedas in one way, shape, or form. And they're either in Sanskrit prose or Sanskrit poetry. Both. The Bhagavad Gita, which is probably the most famous of them all, is a poem. A very long one. And it's in beautiful Sanskrit poetry. 5,000 years ago, Krishna was on the planet. And Krishna is a manifestation of the Godhead, incarnation of God. So Krishna is considered Krishnastu Bhagavan Swayam, to be God himself, not just an avatar. And the situation at the time was there was an internecine conflict between an extended family, the Pandavas, the five brothers, and their cousins, the Kauravas. And the Kauravas had usurped the throne. These are princes, kings, you know, leaders, sovereigns. And of course, that's an old story. You can find that story historically pretty much anywhere. And when God descends or sends an avatar, there's a reason. And the reason is to protect the devotees, the followers of God, and to get rid of those who are causing disruption. The non-followers, depends what they are and what the context is. So get rid of the miscreants, people that are causing disruption. And we're not following Dharma. Of course, Dharma has vast interpretations. But a very simple interpretation of Dharma is doing the right thing for the right reason. Dharma is religion. Dharma is spirituality. It's honesty. It's truth. It's acting for the benefit of all, as well as yourself, as well as Mother Earth. Very importantly, it is acting in harmony with your own nature. You can't be said to be doing your Dharma if you're going against your own nature. How is it possible? Everyone has a particular nature. We know this of each other. We can tell you how someone would, what would they would say and how they'd behave in a certain situation. And then John said, yeah, that sounds like John. That's what he'd say. Yeah, we know exactly what they're like. So we act in harmony with our nature. Everything has a dharma. The dharma of sugar, sweetness. The dharma of fire, heat, light. Can we separate these things? Can we separate sugar and sweetness? It's impossible. Can we separate light and heat from fire? Not possible. What is it about you that we cannot separate from you? That is reflective of your very essence. That's your Dharma. It's not just a religion. It's essentially your religion. Your essential conduct and behavior in relation to the world around you, in relation to your own truth and the world around you. Sometimes people treat others honestly, truthfully, but don't do so with their own selves. They don't tell themselves the truth about themselves, for example. We know that people who do not follow their Dharma, who do not act within reflection of their true essence, are what in life? At the very least, unhappy. Not fulfilled. Ill. Sooner or later, ill. Or the midlife crisis. Right? For example.
Can people... Can some people's Dharma be to be bad? Like Adolf Hitler? Or is that going against his own nature?
No, I think that's true. So we'll point it out, because I was going to talk about the three modes of nature. So depending on your mode of consciousness, and therefore your mode of expression, yeah, it could be your Dharma just to create havoc. That could be your Dharma. Now, in reference to Bhagavad Gita, we wouldn't call it Dharma, we call that adharma. Non-Dharma. Absence of Dharma. Right? So anyway, Krishna did not fight in the ensuing battle between the Kauravas and the Pandavas. That's them on the battlefield. That's Krishna and his cousin and his closest friend Arjuna, who was known as the greatest warrior on the planet at that time. He was an archer. He was the guy. And the Pandavas, that's Arjuna's side, were outnumbered in terms of soldiers and etc. on the battlefield 7-1. Those aren't good odds, typically. And Arjuna said right at the beginning, he says, look, he said to Krishna offered to be his charioteer. He says, I will not fight. I will not participate. Some knew he was God. Some didn't know he was God. Some heard he was God. Some didn't believe he was God. Some, you know, people are jealous of God. What do you mean people are jealous? People are jealous of you. You can find people who are envious of you for one thing or another because of who you are, what you've achieved. People are jealous. So some people are jealous of Krishna. So Krishna agreed to to be the charioteer for Arjuna. He's very famous as Parthasarathi, the charioteer of Arjuna. So Arjuna said, "But draw the chariot up, please, between the two armies. I want to see who has come here to fight." And Krishna took the chariot through the middle of the two armies, Arjuna looked. There was his on the opposite side, opposing side, there was his grandfather, his guru, his uncle, the old king, the blind king, been blind from birth. Many other warriors, many other relatives, cousins, friends that he's known since he was a child. And he's here to get his kingdom back because it was usurped. And finally, he said, became overwhelmed. He said, I can't do it. So Krishna and then Arjuna said, he went on a bit about it. You know, he was kind of working out in his head. Now the dialogue's in there. And he says, he dropped his bow and arrow. He says, I cannot fight. I cannot go off and kill these people. And Krishna says, you know, while speaking learned words, you are mourning for what is not worthy of your grief. So from that point forward, Arjuna says, I am your disciple and a soul surrendered to you. Please instruct me. That was an official acceptance of Krishna as his guru. Now it begins. What was the qualification, or what was the circumstance that had to happen for that to take place? He had to surrender. We have to be able to surrender ego. Even in a classroom where we go to learn. If you enter a classroom and sit down and you think you know it all, you will not learn. Or if you cause disruption in the classroom, or if you second guess, or whatever you might do, you won't learn. The only way you will learn is by being open and receptive. So how did this happen here with Arjuna? He was driven to the point of absolute emotional collapse and desperation. He saw no way out. He actually wanted to just not fight. And he says, I'm going to go off to the forest and become a renunciate. Krishna just sort of smiled. Here's the guy who's been a king and a warrior prince his entire life. Oh yeah, you're going to go to the forest and practice Ashtanga yoga. Okay, that sounds good. Oh, 3 hours. You had enough now? You know, you don't have the nature for that. So, from that point forward, Arjuna surrenders himself. In spiritual subjects, in spiritual philosophical subjects, an absolute surrender is required. An absolute surrender, of course, as we all know, is next to impossible. So what are we surrendering? Essentially, we are surrendering the ego. In spirituality, you're agreeing to surrender the ego. What is the most difficult thing you could possibly surrender in your entire life? Tell me. Your ego. Yeah, I'll surrender a lot of things, but I'm not going to surrender my ego. Right? So he did that. So Krishna says, now you're ready. Now I will instruct you. And from that point forward, that's in the second chapter. First chapter, they tell you who's there to fight. In the second chapter, Bhagavad Gita, this whole thing between Krishna and Arjuna begins. And then he surrenders and Krishna says, no, I'm going to explain. And the entire book, he explains. What does he explain? The entire science of yoga. Which part of yoga? Every part of yoga. This is not Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. He's not getting into all the various asanas and bandhas and various things like that. He's telling you the different kinds and practices of yoga, what they're for, how they work, and what they lead to. So this is about surrender. And when you begin to read it, I mean, you've probably read various spiritual books. A lot of you would have. But when Krishna speaks, he talks about subject matters and lofty explanations and thoughts and perceptions that humans don't talk like this. They don't. This is God speaking. Only God would talk like this, unless you have a better example of it. I read this book in 1972, and it opened my eyes one summer. I paddled my dinghy out to the middle of the lake. I read Bhagavad Gita in the sunshine. When I was 22. And it changed. Everything changed. My life has never been the same since. All bets were off. Or all bets were on, depending on how you want to look at it. And everything changed from there because the shift in consciousness was whole, complete. I'm not saying I went from there to there. Don't misunderstand me. I went from there to there. That flipped me upside down. Okay, now I see the world way differently. Okay, that's essentially what happened. Now, there's many lofty subjects in here that you read it, you go, yeah, well, that sounds really interesting, but there's no, I have no perception of that. I have no experience of it, so there's no way I can prove it, so who knows? That's a reasonable statement. That's an empirical statement. You know, seeing is believing. Yet there are many other things that if you simply observe, you can see and can be proven. And when you see certain subjects that are dealt with that are actually active and effective in life, in the lives of yourself and others, then you, extrapolate on that, and therefore we have to give serious consideration for the other subjects that we're not sure about in the book. You follow me? In the 14th chapter, which is called The Three Modes of Material Nature, which I'm sure some of you are quite familiar with. Verse 5 says, material nature, Krishna is speaking. Material nature consists of the three modes. What are they? Sattva, Rajas, Tamas. Three modes of nature. Goodness, passion, ignorance is one way to translate them. I like to call them contentment, desire, and delusion. That's what I like to call them. It's more, gives me a greater sense. It's not like one's wrong and one's right. It's just various ways to understand. I used to be a professional Sanskrit editor many, many moons ago. And the average Sanskrit word has 22 meanings. That's why you will get vast differences in interpretation. I mean, the Bhagavad Gita has been translated at least, as I said the other day, 60 times by so-called, you know, spiritual adepts and philosophical people and academic people and yogis. This one's translated by my teacher. And Bhaktivedanta Swami. And you'll get a whole different reading from different people. This one, he calls it as it is. And I've read a few translations, and I'd like to say objectively that this is closest to the essence of what this book says that I've seen. Okay, so three modes of nature. When the living entity, soul in essence, comes in contact with nature, he becomes conditioned by these three modes. We talked the other day about Vedic astrology and the moon constellational positions in the sky when you're born, which you look in the birth chart. I won't get into all that, but I'll refer to that in a minute. So we have goodness, passion, ignorance, or contentment, desire, and delusion. Rajas. Rajas is desire. The vast majority of people in the world are governed by Rajas. Vast majority. Western world, the vast majority. I want one of these, two of those, three of those. I got to be here at this time. And, you know, if this doesn't happen, oh, this has got to happen. Oh, God, it didn't happen. I can't believe it. And then, you know, after all I've done for you, sort of thing. Rajas is desire. Desiring the fruits of action. And we all have an endless list of desires, and as it says in the Bhagavad Gita, desires are like rivers entering the ocean. No matter how many rivers enter the ocean never gets filled. How are you? Come on in. It just continues. Desire breeds desire. Right? If you're in Rajas, the mode of passion, are you peaceful? No. City life is considered to be what kind of existence? Rajasic existence. It's a lot of hustle and bustle and rushing around, and we're all in a big hurry. I had to pick up my step here now that I'm in London. I live in the Irish countryside. I can walk very slowly there. It's very beautiful. And the air is pure can be. And there are not a whole lot of people. So if I don't walk a little faster here, you know, it gets dangerous. So, living in the city is rajasic. People in the mode of passion, it's not a state. I'm not saying you can't live in the city and be peaceful. That's why you practice yoga. Well, I hope that's one of the reasons you practice yoga, is to gain peace. It's kind of the antidote for city living, in a sense. You know, as long as we have material desires, there's no peace. As long as we have material desires means connected to the body. We have spirit, we have matter. Spirit is pure spiritual energy. It's called para. It's one of the names for it, para. The superior, supreme energy. Para Shakti. And then we have apara, material energy. And nothing lives or grows in the material world without the presence of spirit. My guru used to give the example, he'd say, look out the window at the airport. Hundreds and hundreds of these amazing machines are parked outside. Huge wings, big jet engines, super duper A380s, multi-decker, amazing engineering. Just sitting there, nothing happening. What's missing? Pilot. And the pilot is a physical body with what inside? A tiny little spark. 1/10,000th size, the tip of a hair. That's how the soul is measured, described. That little spark in the body of that pilot brings matter, in terms of the airplane, to life. That's how powerful it is. Think about it. It's how powerful spirit is. Do we focus on spirit? No. Don't have time, really. No, I'm too busy. Look, I'll take a rain check, okay? No, we run around. Accumulating material things, working on material desires. No, we need certain stuff. I'm not criticizing anybody. But if we make that the goal of life, as we said the other day, what is the destination of birth? How did we say it?
What is the point of birth?
Yeah, what is the point of birth? I mean, where is it going? What's the goal? What is the goal of birth? Many things happen during life. And there are many goals and many things to learn and do. But there's one destination. Only for birth. And it's what? Death. If you can get yourself out of that one, pranams. Let me sit at your feet. I'll take instruction. This is very temporary, this life. It's gone. They describe in the Vedas, human lives are like a bubble resting on the ocean. You've seen bubbles resting on water. A big wave of an ocean. There's a few bubbles just sitting there. One moment. Next moment. Gone. You see about four bubbles there? That's you and your family. Then another life. So it's about getting off that wheel of birth and death. If we're too rajasic, we're always thinking about matter, satisfying the body. The minority of humanity, on either side of rajas, we've got sattva and tamas. Those are minorities. I think you might agree. Tamas is darkness, shadow, ignorance, lethargy, criminality, unevolved, envious, jealous, angry, confrontational, not kind, not understanding. It's tamas. Sometimes it's just lethargy, and sometimes it's active destruction. Tamas is destructive. Sometimes by doing nothing, sometimes by tremendous destruction, acts of destruction.
I thought the tamas was more it was inertia, and the rajas was the active, explosive.
No.
Because if we are so in the West very rajasic, then why are we so? Where is the destruction? Is that we?
Well, modes are always mixed. Modes are mixed. We could look at rajas. Rajas is constructive. Tamas is destructive. If you don't think rajas is, I'm not saying you didn't, but if you think rajas is not constructive, look around you, my friends. Look what we have constructed. Nothing short of marvelous. In so many ways. We're always constructing. We won't even give it a rest. And we have to repair and maintain what we have constructed. Rajas is construction. Tamas is inertia. And then it goes to the far end and it becomes destructive. People who blow things up. People who steal from other people. People who kill. You know, I don't have to tell you, if you don't like somebody, don't kill them. If I said that, you go, what's this guy talking about? Because you have a certain degree of consciousness, you know that. But some people don't know that. So there's shades. There's grades of these things. Rajas is constructive. Ignorance is destructive or lethargic. Does nothing. Lethargic, darkness means it doesn't have an understanding. It doesn't have a perception. Sattva. Sattva is an even greater minority than Thomas. Sattva is the mode of goodness, contentment. I'm satisfied with what I have in life. Great. Doesn't mean if you're in the mode of goodness you can't strive for something. No, you can strive. But the whole point of yoga is to not be attached to the result. Dharma means do your duty. This is the whole thing Krishna's telling Arjuna. Arjuna, you're a warrior. Your kingdom was taken. Your family was put at peril. Your duty as a warrior, as a protector, as a king, as a prince, is to take your kingdom back. You can say, yeah, but I know this guy and I don't want to fight. And it's your duty. If a policeman says, if you say to a policeman, this person is chasing me, they're going to rob me or they're going to mug me. Policeman says, whoa, okay, that's up to you. You handle that. Wait a second. You're the policeman. That's your duty to intervene and offer protection. Otherwise, why are you a policeman? Right? So, sattva means contentment. To accept whatever one gets. And be satisfied, be happy with it. We know we have karma. Our karma gives us some things and not others. If you're, again, it does not mean you can't endeavor for some things in life. But at the same time, you must be grateful and content with what you have. You must not look at your neighbor and say, oh, you know, why does this person have this? You know, this is not even a nice person. You know, that doesn't make sense to me why they have this and I don't have that because I actually want one of those. That's not sattva. So sattva means being satisfied. There's a statement in the Sri Ishopanishad that says, Ishavasyam idam sarvam yatkincha jagachang jagat tena tyaktena bhunjita ma gridaha kasya svidhanam. Everything in the world is controlled and owned by God. Everything. You're just visiting. You don't own anything. No. I own a few acres here. I own a house here. I have a house in Paris. What? At the moment, you do? Not for long. It's so temporal. You're just passing through. When you know everything is owned by God, I spoke about this the other day. You got a father and a mother. God's our father. Earth is our mother. And you have to show some respect or acknowledgement or gratitude to the father and the mother. And so we are just passing through and we give thanks for whatever we have. And don't start tripping over your ego about what we should do and what we should control. You know, I lived in America for most of my life. And the American people, many of them, very enlightened people, especially if you live in California. I was living in California in the 60s. Okay? That's where it was happening. Believe me, it was way ahead of the curve. Way ahead. The 60s essentially went from 65 to 79, 80. It's about 15 years. That was the 60s. As it's known. Anyway, we're here to evolve. If we're in tamas, we must evolve to rajas. If we're in rajas, you must evolve to sattva. Spirituality is not sattva. It's the introduction to sattva, to the mode of goodness. Spirituality is transcendental or beyond the three modes of nature. Beyond that. And spirituality means to do your dharma, whatever your dharma is, and to fulfill yourself, to make a contribution to the world around you. That's your dharma. Yoga means to offer everything to God in this sense. Everything a living being does in the material world creates karma. Anishtam, ishtam, mishram, cha. Karma means undesirable, ishtam, desirable, and mishram, mixed. So how do we get away from karma? We can't get away from karma in the sense that we must act. And every act has a reaction, good, bad, or middling. So we have to act in a higher consciousness. The only way, if at the end of life you've accumulated karma, you'll come back on the wheel of repeated birth and death, samsara, you'll take another birth. So you can suffer, enjoy, and experience your karma. It's like a bank balance, you know. Positive karma is a positive balance, and negative karma, you're in the red. But you still have to experience it. So, the only way to get off the wheel of karma is to become karma-free, which is impossible in terms of action because we still have to act. We always have to act. And the only way to become karma-free is to offer your every action, everything to God. There's a statement in the Bhagavad Gita, yat karoshi yat ashnasi yat jahoshi dadasi yat yat tapasyatsi kaunteya tat karushva madarpanam. Yat karoshi, whatever you do. Yad ashnasi, whatever you eat. Yaj jahoshi, whatever you offer. Dadasi yat, dadasi, whatever you give. Yat tapasyasi. Yogis do tapas. What tapas? Asana is tapas. Dhyana, meditation, is tapas. Right? That's tapas. Talking about this is tapas. How can this be tapas? Because the mind would rather enjoy. I'm not saying this isn't enjoyable, but this is not, you know, the primary instinct of the mind to enjoy, because usually the senses are involved. So, tat kurushva madarpanam. Everything should be done as an offering unto me, unto God, me, Krishna. If that happens, now it does have to be a big to do and a whole production. No. No. A simple thought in the mind. You get your food. Thank you for my food. I offer this to you. Please enjoy. You're in the restaurant. No one heard you. That's it. Now your food has been spiritualized. Why? Because you didn't make yourself the most important person. Return to God what is God's. Offer to God what is God. What's God's? Everything. What isn't God's? Tell me. And you can do a whole ritual, and you know about rituals and ceremonies and vratas, you know vratas. There's many things you could do, far more involved, but it doesn't have to be that involved. It's the thought. It's the intention. Right? We don't need a production. So
it's not the thought, it's the intention.
It is the thought. It's the intention. That's what's important.
But Drew, isn't this a practice of the ego
still? Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But it's not just taming the ego, it's neutralizing karma.
So in this sense, when you change your karma?
In this sense, you do not change your karma in this life. You see, the karma you're experiencing in this life was already set into motion by you in the previous lifetime. So you're suffering or enjoying the karma in this lifetime. Can you change that karma? Some of the karmas are fixed. Some can be changed. So it depends. But if you shift your consciousness and raise your consciousness, that's going to change everything, because your entire outlook will change. No?
But you're also changing it for maybe the next life. It might not be just for this one.
Yeah, you may not get all of the results. Some people, you know, this concept of instant karma. Have you heard of that concept? Boy, I said this, I did that, boom, somebody, I got instant karma. Instant karma is actually a phenomenon. Well, the vast majority of people don't actually get it. Because instant karma happens to really, really evolved souls who are this close to getting off the wheel of samsara, repeated birth and death. that are not going to come back. So, since they're not coming back, we're not going to project that karma forward. Give it to them right now and make them, let them deal with it. That's instant karma. But for the average human being, it's not instant karma. If at the point of death, you have one material desire, one. Material desire is connected to matter, which is connected to the body, which is connected to this world. In relation to anything, one desire, you will get another body. Why? Because you got a desire. And they want you to have what you want. God is all merciful. He's all loving. Here, oh, you still want that? Send her back.
But that would depend on what you've collected. So, what we were saying the other night, to mean that it's a positive next life or a not positive one. It's a desire.
Well, yeah, in the context of the karma overall, sure. Yeah. Sure. But the way you get rid of the karma is to give everything to God. There will be no karma. And get rid of material desires. That means your desires have to become connected to the soul, not the ego. And it's not easy to do that. Because the ego is a very difficult knot to untie. But that's what the yoga process is really about. Yoga, as we know, means union. The root word of yoga is yuj. And in English we have the word yoke. Yoke the bull to the plow and plow the field. So that comes from yoga. It's the union of the soul with God. Any other kind of yoga, like hot yoga and this kind of yoga and aerobic yoga and can't stop the yoga. And not sure about that. Okay, so whatever mode you're in, and the modes are mixed. To be in a pure mode, no one's in a pure mode. I mean, it's like shades of shades of shades that are taking place that one goes through. So, you know, it's like a color palette. When you look at a painting of an artist, you wonder sometimes, well, how did he get this color? Well, he might use four colors to get that color. You know, don't know. But in, what's the color palette they usually say for the modes of nature? There's one they give. Red for rajas, blue for ignorance, I believe.
And white.
White for sattva. I think that's what it is. Essentially, how we interact with the world around us, just changing the subject here, is encapsulated beautifully by the breathing process. All there is in this world is expansion, contraction, giving, receiving, or giving, taking. It's a little different than receiving. So when you breathe in, are you giving or receiving?
Receiving.
Yeah. You're receiving oxygen, and most importantly, you're receiving prana, you're receiving chi. Because what's in oxygen is prana. And prana, or chi, is life force. So, then there's breathing out. is giving in that sense, giving, receiving. It's what you give, what you offer. So, as a person, are you a giver, primarily, or are you a receiver? My experience has been that people are usually predominantly one or the other. We're both. We need to be, naturally. You couldn't breathe if you weren't. But predominantly, one. Are you a giver or are you a receiver? Are you a giver or are you a taker? When you come in contact with a person, especially somebody you know, there's an exchange of energy. Now, you may go down to the news agent and buy a newspaper and give your pound and say thank you, and you know, a small exchange. There's many of these. It's a kind of a neutral exchange. Sometimes people call you on the phone or come to see you, and they drain you. Did they fill you? Did they drain you? That's all you're gonna, when you get off the phone, did you just get filled or did you get drained? Or was it neutral? Or when they've come to see you and then they leave, you go, God, that was draining. Or, I don't know what's wrong with me. I have no energy. You don't want to be a person who drains others. Overly needy. Desperate. Many people, this world, this material world, it's a very difficult place. It is a very difficult place. So, people are suffering, honestly, a lot of the time. I'm not being pessimistic and dark. It's a fact. I've been doing Vedic astrology for 39 years. I've heard all the stories. I've been doing it around the world. I've heard the stories. You've heard the stories. You've lived the stories. We're souls. We don't belong here. We don't belong here. How do you know? Because you're going to die. None of you want to. Because we get old and none of us want to. We get diseased, none of us want to. We suffer. None of us want that. We are fish out of water in the material world. The material world, oh, this is the thing that I couldn't remember. It came back to me. There was a great spiritual teacher in this line of my guru. He used to say, this is just a journey you're on here in the world, in this lifetime. It's just a journey. Well, that's fair enough. We can understand that. So supposing in the middle of your journey you stop off at the inn, at the hotel, for the night. So then you start deciding how you're going to redecorate your room. You call up the furniture people and the decorator and the carpet person. And no, why would you do that? It's absurd. That's essentially what we do. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't decorate your house, but I thought it was a great analogy. We're so busy decorating, redecorating, and getting so caught up in this, you'll be gone in no time. We take it too seriously. How'd you like the room? Yeah, well, it's okay, I've seen better, kind of thing. You know, wherever you end up, hotel. God, I'm glad we're only staying there one night. Don't pick this place anymore. Husband and wives fight over that kind of stuff too, you know. So, yeah, fish out of water. That's what we are here in the material world. That's why we need to get off the wheel. So, if you teach, if you give, if you provide, if you enlighten, if you uplift, coach, inspire, motivate, guide, advise, counsel. What did I miss? Oh, most of them. Always give something. It's energy. What do we want? We want energy. It comes in many forms. We want energy. So give.
But most people would say that they do that, don't they? Most people.
Most people would probably do that in one way or another.
But is it the intention behind it? So some people would say they feel very put upon, or they wouldn't like their circumstances because they would feel that they were always, you know, in a vulnerable position, or they never had the upper hand because they wouldn't necessarily see that they were actually giving.
Well, what that brings to mind for me, I have met many, many people who give a tremendous amount, very kind and generous and accommodating, but they don't draw the line, the boundary. And then people will take advantage. Some people will just take you for everything they can, if you let them. That's not good. And these people need to draw a reasonable boundary because this person's draining them. Can I come and stay with you for a week? I'm in between places. Yeah, sure. Come stay for a week. 4 months later. You still here? Yeah. I really like your house. I notice. It doesn't look like my house anymore, though. Feel like my house.
People can give as well for, you know, knowing that if they're going to give to that person, will it be because I know that, you know, hopefully they'll help me out later and I'll need their support for this, and it's your own.
Well, yeah, so, but that's, yeah. That's conditional,
like,
though.
Done so, and then that, I want that to be.
Yeah, it's conditional, and then when it doesn't manifest, then what?
They get frustrated.
We call that mutually beneficial, don't we?
Well, being mutually beneficial is fine, you know.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's terrible. It's mutually beneficial. People say,
you help me, I'll help you.
Well, out of that.
Yeah, no, if we're both on the wavelength, you know, let's say, well, let's make a deal. Let's have an agreement. And I'll be happy to help you with this. When this comes up for me, could you give me a hand with that? Yeah, no problem. That was always the old way in rural cultures, farming cultures. The guy's putting up his barn, all his neighbors come and help him erect his barn or help him get the crop in on time, his harvest.
But if you gave, say, for example, to charity and you want to have a nice, whatever it is, auditorium put up with your name put on it or for an event named after you.
That's not, see, giving to charity would be motive goodness, generosity, kindness, help, philanthropy, altruism,
yeah.
Right? But when you want to see your name on the plaque and you picture in the newspaper with the big check, you know, and the photograph signed by you, shaking the hand of the mayor or whomever, that's rajas. Now, sattva has become rajas.
Was it rajasic sattva?
Yeah, it's mixed.
Yeah.
It's mixed.
Can see that, and they're setting an example for other people as well, like some teacher Johnson or something. They're doing this thing, they're inspiring people as well.
Like just an athlete or a famous person.
Yeah, yeah, just like, you
it's
know,
a good effect.
Yeah, giving your, you know, like a blood donation and spreading the word, okay, I'm doing that and other people should. Could be there a very fine line between them?
Yeah, so I know lots of general assholes. Yeah. Those are the best words. I do, I know lots of people. They're very.
Yeah.
I don't get juju. I don't know, you know, there's lots that I can think of who are really complicated, quite. Not very nice people.
Yeah.
Extremely generous.
Yes,
people.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
You know, and I try not to.
It's better that they be generous.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I wouldn't criticize them for being generous. You take people at whatever level they come. Now, some people go into spirituality. Why? Why do they go into yoga practice, for example? Some of them go into yoga practice, some go into tantra. Tantra is a much lower mode. And tantra has elements sometimes of tamas in it. Sometimes it's called the left-hand path. And if you want to practice, yoga will give you siddhis. Siddhis are powers. Serious yoga practice over a period of time will produce siddhis. That's a byproduct of yoga practice. If, for example, I'm not just trying to say yoga practice itself, but you're all yogis, so that's we can talk about yoga practice. I mean, there are different ways one can achieve these things, you know, not just yoga. So, if you want to gain powers, for example, a tantric can become a very powerful person, especially a dark tantric, and he gains power over darkness, dark powers. To do what? This is power over people, or power against people, or power to manipulate people and circumstances. That's tamasic. It is, in some sense, spiritual practice, but it's tamasic, or yoga practice, for the wrong reason. Is there ego in that? Fully invested ego. Now, you go up to another stage, you go up to rajasic yoga. Now I want to practice because I'm trying to achieve material success in certain ways. I want money, I want fame, I want a wife, I want a husband, I want a house, I don't know. You know, I want a position.
A lot of the mantras.
Still ego in there somewhere.
The mantras from the tantra.
Yeah.
Lineages,
yeah. Yeah. No, you got. There are mantras for everything. I have mantras. My head is crammed with mantras. And I also have some tantric mantras that I've learned from, you know, Agni Purana or Nrsinga Purana. Well, Nrsinga Purana is a mode of goodness, but Shiva Purana, I should say. Then you go up to the next level and you get yoga for Ashtasiddhi, for the yogic powers of anima, lagima, prapti. Anima, becoming atomic in size. Lagima, lighter than the lightest. Prapti, reaching out, grabbing anything you want. What are they? Do you know? Anima, lagima, prapti.
Very big.
Yeah. Well, we don't have to look them all up, but that's another level. The highest level is love. Unconditional love. That's bhakti. Bhakti is devotion. And in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says to Arjuna, Man mana bhava mad bhakto mad yaji mam namaskuru. Man mana always think of me. Bhava Mad Bhakto, become my devotee. Madhyaji Mam, worship me. Namaskuru. Namaskuru. Namaskar. So the highest level of yoga is surrender. Near the last verse of the entire Bhagavad Gita, Sarvadharman Parityajya Mam Ekam Sharanam Vraja Aham Tvam Sarva Papebhyo Moksha Yishyami Ma Shucha. He says, I'm going to explain to you every kind of dharma imaginable. They're all in here. They're all in here. All of them. Good, bad, sideways, dark, light, shady. And at the end he says, Sarva Dharman Parityaja, give up all these forms of dharma. Forget it. Forget about it. Let it go. Mam Ekam Sharanam Vraja, just come surrender to me. Sharanam. Take shelter, surrender to me, Mom, me. Mam Ekam Sharanam Vraja. Aham Tvam Sarva Papebhyo. I will free you. Aham Tvam Sarva Papebhyo. Moksha Yishyami. I will free you, Moksha, from Sarva Papa. What's Papa? Sinful reaction. Negative karmic reaction. Do you know this word, Papa? What do they call the Pope in Italy? Papa.
It's dad in German.
Yes, it's dad in many languages. It's true. But Papa means sin in Sanskrit.
Right.
The original word, which of course, as words travel down, they change, no? The original word is papaha, destroyer of sin. Ha means destroyer. Destroyer of papa. We got a pope here. He's not the destroyer. He's just the papa. He forgot about the ha part. It's interesting, you know. Sarva pape bio. I will free you from moksha yishami, ma shucha. Don't worry. Don't worry. I'll take care of it. There's nothing for you to worry about. So in other words, give it all to God. What do we want? More than anything, we want love. That's what we want. We want love. We're all searching for love. With our mate and with all of our relationships, with our friends, our children, our parents, everywhere. Why not God? Why do we edge him out? Why not Mother Earth? She's always getting the short end of the stick these days. Sorry? So there are three levels of advancement in spiritual practice or yoga practice. Kanishta Adhikari, Majjhima Adhikari, and Uttama Adhikari. My old frame's getting stiff. Kanishta Adhikari, Kanishta means a neophyte, beginner. Got to begin somewhere. We get very excited when we begin something, especially when we have a a resonance with it. And we start to practice it. And we begin to feel the changes in our bodies, in our mind. They tell you, well, if you do this, this, and this, this will start happening. And you go, oh my God, it's happening. Excuse me. It works. What is the greatest pitfall for the neophyte practitioner? It's the first pitfall. Let's say you've been practicing yoga, come on, for a year, okay? 2 months? Not enough. Let's say for a year, going on a year, right? And you can do all these asanas, and you know, you can do this, you can do that, and you. New? Are you new? Oh no, I've been here a while. Can't you tell? First pitfall is, aren't I advanced? Number one pitfall. I'm advanced. Now, you may be advanced. You may be advancing. But as soon as you think you're advanced, that is, I'm better than that. Look at this. She calls that an asana. I'm better than that. Now, at that moment, guess what? You're no longer advanced. You just slip back down. You just slip back down. The old ego pulled the rug right up, pulled the yoga mat right out from under you. The advancement, yeah, I know, in the asanas and the practice, I'm not denying that. That's not the main point. You know, yoga is not for weight loss and exercise. Yeah, it has those benefits. That's not the point. You need to diminish the ego, reduce the ego. How much love, how much compassion do we develop? That's really the point. How, to what degree do we become God conscious? So, that's often a pitfall for beginners in any discipline, really. Then, Madhyama Adhikari, middle level. I think they get the word medium from Madhyama. Sounds like it anyway, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Is a person who's now developed conviction about the practice. They have conviction. And they have facility and familiarity. But they're not necessarily, they may not be yet so, how shall I say, theoretically expert. They may not understand everything. They may not be able to communicate it in a way that can help others or can convince others or can answer all the questions, etc. Their practice is better, but they're not in a position yet where their impact on others makes that much of a difference. That's Madhyama. It's really about understanding the philosophy of what you're doing and really embodying that. So you also have to understand philosophically what you're doing, not just in terms of the asanas, physiologically, if you will. And then Uttama means
ultimate.
Topmost. What?
Ultimate.
Correct. You're right. Ultimate. Then there's full conviction. And that's when the embodiment, it's the, how do we say? Walk the talk. It's the embodiment of it. Where what you say actually changes lives. The words are then suffused with. You see, you can sit and explain something to somebody and explain exactly what the theory is behind it and explain the asana or whatever. And it's all correct. But it doesn't make that much of an impression on anybody. They just go, oh, yeah. When you've reached the Uttama stage, your words, your energy in yoga practice, your practice itself is suffused with prana, with chi. So when you move, when you say, when you speak, people's lives change.
Manifest.
People go, oh.
When do you know when you're next? Because if you acknowledge it, it's the first pitfall.
Yeah, but you can acknowledge the place you are at, my dear, without ego. The pitfall in the neophyte stage, that's ego.
Yeah.
You've seen these people, God bless you. You've seen these people, maybe you're one of them. There's an energy coming off, and that energy is not spiritual, it's egocentric. Okay? And when you're there at the Uttama stage, it's not egocentric. It's a knowing, it's a being. It's not an awakening like down at this level. It's not a becoming like it is on this level. It's a being. And it, you can acknowledge it, but better than anything. True advancement in spiritual practice brings what? Humility. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was on the planet 500 years ago, who introduced the Dharma for this age, which is chanting names of God, Sankirtan Yajna, because each age, universal age, has a different Dharma, different practice. Not that you can't do other practices, but each age has a certain dharma. He said, Tranadapi sunichena taror iva sahishnuna amanina manadena kirtaniya sada hari. Which means, Tranadapi sunichena, one must become lower than a blade of grass. Taror iva sahishnuna, as tolerant as a tree. What is more tolerant than a tree? It's out in the elements all day long, every day. You can go to a tree and you can do all kinds of things to it if you wanted to. You can carve names in it. It won't complain. It's tolerant as a tree. Amanina means it's no ego. Humility. In this state of mind, amanina amanadena kirtaniya sadahari, in this state of mind one can chant the names of God constantly. In other words, in a pure state. So that the chanting will have the maximum effect. Essentially, humility. So the more we can reach that stage of humility, the more that's where the power actually lies. Because there's something so pure and innocent and attractive about humility. It's childlike. Your child comes up to you and says, "Mommy, what about this, this, and this?" and asks you one of those profound questions, you know, or some, you know, mystery of the universe that your little child's been thinking about. And then you explain as best as you can. And the child goes, "Oh, okay, I see." That child, in a childlike state, is completely humble. There's no ego in that expression. He will accept what you've said. Why? Because he trusts you completely. Even if you explained it wrong, he'll still accept it. And that's the beauty of that childlike state. This is not saying Christianity, one must become like a child to enter the kingdom of God. Childlike, innocent, pure. And come on, look around, my friends. Who has more joy than anyone? Go to the playground, check it out. If you don't believe me, unabandoned joy for no particular reason. Running around, jumping on swings and seesaws and whatever. Just goes. We get older, we get burdened and burdened and burdened. So many cares.
Is that our karma?
No, my dear, that is our identification with matter. It's not necessarily our karma. Yeah, we can have difficult karma, but how do you deal with it? The active ingredient is always free will. You always have a choice in how to deal with things. You may not be able to change circumstances and some occurrence that has just taken place. You have complete freedom to determine how you will react to it. It's your karma that something just happened. And it would have been better had it not happened, but there it is. We can't undo that. So how will you respond to it?
That's yours. The reaction is yours.
The reaction, yeah. Are you going to react or are you going to act? There's only three kinds of action. In astrology, we look to Mars, planet of action. There's action, reaction, and inaction. That's it. The vast, I mean, this is, please sit down, make sure you're sitting when I tell you this. The vast majority of people do what?
React.
React. Don't they? Because so-and-so said this, because they told me this, they said I had to do that, and if I didn't, boy, I'd be in trouble. And that's been going on since you were born, by the way. Okay? Now, here's your exercise. When you go home, you take a piece of paper, draw a line down the middle. On the left-hand side, you write down everything you ever did in your life since you were young that you can remember.
Not one piece of paper.
And on the, well, you might have more than one piece of paper. And on the right-hand side, write why you did it. I took piano lessons. My mother made me. I play football. I love football. I took up Celtic dancing. I hate Celtic dancing. Whatever. I study law. My whole family are lawyers. I had a guy walk in one time. Real nice looking man, you know, prosperous. L.A. I says, how's it going, Bill? Yeah, good. So what do you do? I'm an attorney. Okay. And how's that going for you? Terrible. So why'd you become an attorney? Because my dad's an attorney. My two uncles are attorneys. My two brothers are attorneys. Grandfather's an attorney. Oh, so I guess you come from a family of attorneys. I hate being an attorney. It's reactive. It's not for him. He did it. He was told to do it. Have you not studied something in university you were told to study? What do you mean art history? How are you going to use art history for anything? What are you going to, teach? No. I'm not using you as an example, because I know you studied art history. But, you know, that's, well, why are you studying this? There's no money in that. You know what the what people are pursuing in university now in the last, I don't know how many years, probably 20. The subject they pursue more, than, postgraduate, than anything. Master's in Business Administration. You like business? I don't know. Never did it. Well, why are you going to get an MBA? Well, you're going to make money. Oh, you need to make money. You can make a lot of money if you have an MBA. Is that your dharma? Is that your passion? Is that what you've been dreaming about since you were a little child? Figures and numbers and calculation? No. I've been a carpenter. I like working with wood. Women. Why don't you become a high-end carpenter, cabinet maker? You know?
That also because it's Kali Yuga, and often, for example, being a yoga teacher, it's not something that necessarily...
Yeah, yoga teacher. Yeah, come on. You're not serious about life. You're a yoga teacher.
But what I mean is you can't necessarily make your living completely through being a yoga teacher. I mean,
no.
A teacher can't.
That's right.
But that's because of the Kali Yuga that we're in, that it's making it less...
Well, Kali Yuga is having a terrible effect on everything. The Iron Age that we're in now. In the universe, women who want to stay home with their babies should not have to go to work. And I'm not trying to turn back the hands of time for feminism, believe me. They should not have to go to work, because look at the effect this is having on society. You know, it's very difficult. So it's so many things are there now, and then of course childcare costs a fortune. You know, it's crazy. So these are all various kinds of effects of Kali Yuga, because Kali Yuga is deepening the mode of ignorance and the mode of passion. We're all supposed. Why does it take when I grew up? Was a long time ago, 50s. One income was enough to live on. You know, my father worked and my mother worked sometimes, not full time, just to get out of the house more than anything, you know. And now it's standard. You got a husband and wife. Well, you got, what do you mean you're not working? You got to have a job. So I'll call you.
What does the Kali Yoga mean? Is that we're in the that period now? Like, I'm not familiar with that.
The universe is four seasons. Eras or epochs, just like we have four seasons. And they're called yuga. Yuga means age, not yoga. Yuga means age. The golden age, the Satyuga, the silver age, the Treta Yuga, the bronze age, Dwapara Yuga, and the iron age, Kali Yuga. The brain is gone. The Iron Age, Kali Yuga. And they're a cyclical pattern that repeats itself. The four ages taken together are 4,320,000 years. So Kali Yuga itself is 432,000 years, human years in length. And then the Bronze Age is 864,000 years. That's Dwapara Yuga. Treta Yuga, Silver Age, is, I'll tell you in a minute. The Silver Age is 1,296,000 years in length. And the Golden Age, thank God, is 1,728,000 years in length. So at the end of Kali Yuga, the Iron Age that we're in now, the Golden Age will reappear. In the Golden Age, people live for 100,000 years lifespan. In the Silver Age, 10,000. In the Bronze Age, 1,000. In the Iron Age, 100. If you know anybody who's lived for 100, because most don't, even now. We are only advanced 5,000 years into the Iron Age now. The Iron Age began when Krishna left the planet 5,000 years ago. So we only have, and this is the age of quarrel, hypocrisy, destruction, when people prey upon others, cheating, quarrel. Well, quarrels, wars and battles and manipulation, power over people, theft, embezzlement, power and money in the hands of the few. You know, what do people do with billions of... What does one man do with the several billion dollars? You answered that one pretty quickly. No, I mean one. Yeah, okay, that's fair enough. One man
builds a wall.
Builds a wall. Meaning, we could take a couple of billion of those dollars and feed a whole lot of people, and make a passable, reasonable life for a lot of people. I mean, no one needs that much money. That's all. That's simply the point. So we only have 427,000 years left in Kali Yuga. But we're also going through a period of sort of a minor period of a golden age with a rise in consciousness and awareness, which, according to Vedic understanding, was brought in about 500 years ago and supposed to last for 10,000 years. But even, you know, having been, as I said, lived in the 60s, that was a huge shift in consciousness. And you had to have been there to really experience it. I mean, people were just in this peace, love, and connection. Strangers from any country you want to imagine. It was really something. I've never seen it since then, before or since. But it inaugurated or ushered in a new consciousness. Now, in fairness, to be honest, we've returned to materialism considerably since the 60s. And a lot of the so-called flower children, as they were called back in the day, who have returned to materialism, a lot of them. So I guess maybe we could say they weren't really spiritual to begin with if they returned to materialism. Anyway, I didn't finish saying, when you draw your line down the middle of your page and you list all the things, you write why you did it. Was it action? Was it reaction? Were you proving somebody right? Were you proving somebody wrong? Were you forced to do it by your loved one? Were you trying to please somebody, yet it had nothing to do with your own truth or your own dharma? Right? Got it? Now add them up. How many acts are real action, are a product of you, who you are in your lifetime thus far, and how many are reactive in nature? Then you'll see how advanced you are in terms of your consciousness. Now, this is not the only way to measure such a thing, but it, in terms of action, it is. And the third thing, in action, it's not on the, on your sheet with the line on it. In action means not doing what you're supposed to do. Not acting, not reacting, just neglecting. Or you say, tomorrow, there's the three things that I plan to do tomorrow. For whatever reason. Hopefully they're all active, not reactive. And then tomorrow comes and goes, and you did none of them. That's inaction. And of course, the very famous expression of inaction is called procrastination. No, I will get to it, I promise. I will get to it when? Soon. This week? One of these weeks. One of the weeks. 52. Relax. But that will show you a lot about yourself. And you may say, yeah, well, you know, that's real nice, Drew, but, you know, I have a family, I have children, I have obligations, I have a job. Yeah, I know. Me too. I had an awakening at 19, and I got to Eastern philosophy very quickly, and I started practicing. I went to yoga classes and started meditation and got initiated into TM and meditation. Got real into it back then. But I didn't. I actually lived in an ashram for 5 years practicing yoga. Bhakti yoga, mantra. Where? I started in Toronto and then moved to LA. Then I never figured out, even though I felt I was doing the right thing spiritually in terms of my spiritual growth, what never became clear to me, it took me quite some time to figure out, was, yeah, but are you doing your purpose? Are you doing your dharma? I was doing my dharma in terms of spiritual practice. What was I doing my dharma out in the world? When I left the ashram, went back in the world, the real world. And I had to do different jobs that I absolutely hated. We all have to do jobs at some point in time, especially when you're younger. But I never actually figured out what my purpose was until I was 33. It came to me with a clarity at age 33. So did I start doing my purpose, my dharma, the next day, you ask, and I say, no, I did not. That took till I was 39. And was pretty much well underway at 40, 41.
Between the time that you had that realization until 40, where it was established, were you laying the bricks?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I was laying the bricks actually much earlier than that, but I didn't really realize I was laying the bricks as clearly. I actually was following my purpose all along, but I didn't have the clarity. I actually was following my purpose, I'd say, from 19 in terms of the journey.
The same thing as having intent and having the will to do something.
Yeah.
In the same way as you can have, you've built a brick wall or you've built an Airbus F380, but you haven't become the pilot and you haven't gone into it yet.
Yeah, exactly. And you have to be kind to yourself too, you know. You can't beat yourself up and be overly self-critical. Your criticism of self must be constructive. Not destructive. If your self-criticism is destructive, what happens? You close the channel, close the flow. Expansion, contraction. Right? When you use positive criticism, constructive criticism, try it on your children. You know how it works. Now we got a channel. Now the energy's flowing. It's funny how oftentimes we can love others, but we can't fit ourselves in. You know, how come you're so good to all these people, but you don't seem to be very good to yourself? What? Why don't you give yourself a break? Why don't you recognize your own value, your own worth? You're in the mix, you know. You're part of it all. You're inside the bubble. You're not outside. You're part of it. Questions, comments, insights,
what do you do?
Conflicted arguments.
What do you do in Ireland? Where do you live in Ireland? We have a very good friend in Ireland.
I live in Wicklow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wicklow Mountains.
Yeah. In the Wicklow Mountains, at the bottom of a valley between two rivers. Irish postcard location. Outside of Enniskerry, in Glencree Valley, right near the Powers Court waterfall, if you know that.
It's not far from Dublin.
No,
it's about a half an hour, maybe half an hour, 40 minutes from Dublin. Yeah,
I went to Glendalough.
Yeah, it's not so far. Not so far from Glendalough.
And do you teach, Drew, or do you teach in Ireland, or do you teach this sort of thing?
I've been traveling for the last 25 years all over the place. Essentially, I do Vedic astrology. I have clients around the world. And I also do guided healing meditation work for the purpose of healing. And I'm speaker... Sorry, I'm a little tired tonight. But speaker, author, you know.
You do your satsangs at the...
I do satsangs at my house, you know, small, low key. I also speak to 1,000, 2,000 people at a time in big arenas.
Do have a question. I'm going to ask it even though it might be stupid. But I keep wondering that, because we were talking, or you were talking about devotion, right? And desire, How does that sort of fit into the Rajas, Tamas, and Sattva situation?
Well, it depends. What is the object of your desire? What is the object of your devotion?
Well, it's in the story, it's Krishna, right? It's God.
And it's God, yeah.
In Ishta Yoga, we really don't really have, like, we don't really say God. We have Brahman, right, Emily?
God is not a word, it's an entity,
it's not a God.
Yeah.
And I was reading the other day that in the story, Krishna, it's in the interpretation, not in the original, but he was saying the sort of, if you devote yourself to that, to that sort of entity, universal intelligence, as we call it, right, rather than to him, it takes you a lot longer to sort of...
That's right.
Do you know what I'm...
Yeah.
That's a part in this.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I read that I don't quite get it. Why?
Because it's tantric as well, Ishta.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
but he was like, it's in the story, and I'm just wondering.
It is.
How
it's in the verse.
The
impersonal method of seeing God as energy is far more difficult. It takes much longer to reach the goal.
Oh.
God is realized in three phases: as Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan.
Mm-hmm.
Name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Mm-hmm. Holy Trinity. Okay? I'm not using Christianity as the source. This is the source. Brahman is God as energy. Brahman is simply spirit. Spirit pervades everything. We cannot have a material existence, the material world, without spirit as the matrix upon which the material world exists. And that movie, The Matrix, had some great insights. It's kind of like, well, this is a clever way to do it, but they did it with code. You know, it's clever. So, you can realize God is energy. You can merge into the energy, which you may have been recommended to do. That is a level of God realization.
But isn't that self-realization?
Self-realization, God realization, same thing, really. And, well, it isn't the same thing on that level. It is the same thing. Let's put it that way. But the tendency is to merge, which means to lose your individuality and your identity. So a lot of Mayavad, that's called Mayavad philosophy, a lot, and that's quite common in India, by the way. This is very common. People often think that the material world is such a place of suffering. And here we are as individuals with individual identities and lives, that the spiritual world, which is supposed to be Sat Chit Ananda, eternity, knowledge, bliss, must absolutely be the opposite of that, where we have no identity, no individuality, and we lose ourselves in the all-pervading energy of Brahman, spirit. Okay? Is that true? It's true at the first level of God realization, which is energy. Okay? The next level is Paramatma, God in the heart. We're an Atma. In this, each of us is a soul, an Atma, or a Jiva, if you like, right? Pretty much everybody knows they got a soul, except atheists, but they get religion real fast at the point of death. Atheists do. Even if there is a God, can you help me now? You know. God bless them. So, Paramatma is within each person is both an Atma and a Paramatma. God in the heart, as well as the soul, individual soul. So when you say Namaste, Namaskar, Pranam, what are you saying? Are you bowing down to this person? No. You're bowing down to, you could say, the soul, but more specifically, God in the heart. The yogis, the gyanis, those who follow a path of the cultivation of spiritual knowledge, their ultimate goal is Brahman realization. Okay? The yogis, like Ashtanga yogis, follow their path is Paramatma realization, or realizing that God is in the hearts of everything and everyone. Apandita samadarshinaha, it says, that the wise person, samadarshi, sees everyone equally. There's no judgment. If you see the soul, you don't say this one's above this one, this one's below that one. You don't see like that anymore. We see like that on the material plane. And before I tell you about, and that one's called diversity, because you're seeing God in all these diverse forms. It's not just one homogeneous energy, it's God in all the forms. That's Paramatma. Now, just to digress just for a moment, in Buddhism, you always look at the ultimate goal. That's how you look at anything. So where exactly are we going? If you get in the car with me and I'm driving, what is one of the first things you're going to say to me? Where are we going? Aren't you? Even if you just want, hey, are you going somewhere? Yeah, I'm going to go in the car right now. I'll come along for a ride. Yeah, come on. And before, how long will it take before you ask me, well, where are you going? Where are we going? That's going to be one of the first things that comes out of your mouth, right? How come we don't do that in spiritual practice? In Buddhism, the highest state in Buddhism is, tell me, Nirvana. You know what Nirvana means? Cessation of existence. Non-existence. Vana means forest. They subjected to the rules of Vritti in Sanskrit, and Vana becomes Vana, which means material creation. Forest becomes material creation. Vana. Nir means negates it. Cessation of existence. That's why all these Buddhist Rinpoches come back down to do charitable work. You know, they always say, oh, this is so-and-so. Let's show him his stuff when he was in his last life. See if he recognizes. And they recognize a lot of the stuff. And that's, you know, because, oh, Nirvana, what's, there's nothing on offer. Nirvana. So, you know, is this supposed to be where the party is? Nothing going on. Let's go home. Nirvana. Okay, that's a side note. So the highest level of God realization is Bhagavan. God is person. Why? And the person is not a material person with a material body. God is spirit, pure spirit. And he's absolute. Everything about him is absolute. It's pure spirit. There's nothing contaminated by the material energy. He's not under the influence of the three modes of nature. He's transcendental. So why would we be interested in that? Because we are personal. There's a person behind everything. We like personal relationships. We could have invited you to come to this lovely home on Holland Park Avenue. Why don't you come to this lovely home on Holland Park Avenue? Why? What's going on there? Mm-hmm. Nothing at all. This is a home. What? Why would I come there? Well, so-and-so's going to be there, and so-and-so's going to be there, and this is going to happen, that's going to happen. Because there's all these different people. It's person behind everything. You can't have a relationship unless you have a subject and an object. You're the subject. These, you know, I'm the subject, you're the objects. You're the subject, I'm the object, etc. And then we can have a reciprocation in exchange, hopefully a loving reciprocation. Why? Because we like that. Friendly, at least, loving, better. But you don't know. You can do that with God. God likes that too. It was His idea. We didn't invent this. He did. It's His concept. As above, so below. Well, if you enjoy loving relationships with different people in different ways, why not God? You do not lose your identity. You keep your individuality. Not necessarily who you are now, because there is an eternal identity that each person has, and that's called your siddha deha, your perfected body, your spiritual body, which you don't realize until you've purified yourself enough of your material conditioning and identification. You understand? So, there's your choice. You got three levels of God realization. The one they've been teaching you is energy. Okay. So going back to this Father, Son, Holy Spirit crossing yourself, Father is God as personality. Holy Spirit is energy. What about the Son? It's not one Son. Hello. We are sons and daughters of God. So that this is God in diversity. Jesus Christ, the only Son of God. You mean He's that limited? He could only do one Son? Well, He doesn't like girls. I want you to have boys. Don't have any girls.
Come on. Can I ask a very stupid question?
I haven't heard any stupid questions yet.
Because it's just so out of this concept.
Are you Spanish?
No, I'm Iranian.
Oh.
I realize, not just tonight, but generally, it became more evident for me. Why, whenever we talk about God or spirit, or why we always do this?
Yeah, we don't have to do that. God's here right now.
Why is here? Why we move the energy here? Why is always up there?
You're right.
Not there, not there.
It's here. It's all around us. They're just different dimensions. It's conditioning. No, no, God, no. Everything is everywhere. This is like we are on a certain frequency, right? If we take a radio right now and turn the tuning dial, we're going to get different radio stations, right? Different bandwidth. All we do is turn the dial. Do we have to move to a different room to get a different radio station? No. So, you're right. All the different levels and dimensions of existence are all here, right now. You have to be able to change the frequency. What was that old song? What's the frequency, Kenneth?
I'm sorry.
Please, we've got to get back to the train.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Good. Thanks for coming. Nice to meet you.
I think, thank you. You sound like big time moment. This is supposed to be his quieter night. And we've like,
yeah, well done.
But really.
Well, that's absolutely fantastic.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
This is all very kind.
We have, yeah.
Oh, 8:30, was that our time? I don't know. Yeah, it's just, it's organic. It's organic. It's just, it happens, you know.
I know.
Thank you so much for your kind attention.
True, honestly, thank you for everything, for all the energy and everything.